exchange is not an eternal pattern in world history, but it did organize some very significant developments during much of the early modern period, some of which, including China's population growth, would continue to ramify thereafter. Third basic feature of the early modern period, the extent to which gunpowder was utilized to establish a new series of empires in a way that actually had never before been matched in world history. This was a great age of empire at two levels. First, familiar. The Europeans, launched by the Spanish and Portuguese, established their famous overseas empires in the Americas, in parts of Asia and Africa, as we've already discussed. So Spanish, Portuguese, Dutch, British, French empires become the great overseas empires of the early modern period with huge consequences in world history. But equally important, indeed for much of the early modern period, more important, was the establishment of land-based gunpowder empires in Asia. The Ottoman Turks, for example, had used gunpowder, had used cannon in their siege of Constantinople. The establishment of the Ottoman Empire was partly based on the use of land-based cannon and guns. The new Mughal Empire in India was similarly organized by invaders who utilized new weaponry. The Safavid Empire in Persia was another gunpowder empire. The expanded Russian Empire quickly became a fourth gunpowder empire. So, in Eastern Europe and much of Asia, a new series of empires arose on the basis of new military technology, quite different in orientation from the more commercially minded European overseas empires, but equally important because they maintained sway over such a significant landmass and over such dynamic economies. And even in China, the last dynasty, which launched in the 17th century, the Qing dynasty, was itself partly a gunpowder empire operated by Manchurians, not Chinese proper, who used new weaponry as one of their means of obtaining new political control on the Chinese mainland. This establishment of empire, which goes way beyond the familiar story of the rise of the West, is a crucial development in the early modern period that deserves attention in its own right. A couple of things did not happen in world history in this period. The early modern period is not a distinct period with regard to gender relations, for example. The post-classical period, with the complicated impact of the world religions on gender relations, but also the pattern of increasing subservience of women in a number of key societies, such as China, post-classical period suggests a break in gender relations, but in terms of the world as a whole, the early modern period did not. There were important developments. The arrival of Europeans in the Americas had huge implications for American gender relations because European values and expectations differed so greatly from Native American traditions. The slave trade, in withdrawing men from Africa, increased the importance of polygamy in Africa because of the need to provide family arrangements for the remaining women. Again, a significant gender change. So there are points of change in specific cases, but there's no blanket pattern that allows us to use the early modern period for purposes of gender discrimination. The same thing, interestingly, applies to culture. There are all sorts of cultural developments in the early modern period, and we will have to pay attention to them. The importation of European religion, artistic styles, and some science to the Americas was a huge change in American cultural history. European culture itself would change, and we'll be taking this up quite specifically with, for example, the rise of science, the division of European Christendom, etc. European cultural patterns would have some impact on a few other societies, particularly Russia, but in the world as a whole, in the early modern period, there is no overall cultural dynamic. It's as though, and I think in some cases this is really exactly the situation, it's as though individual societies like Japan, even as new opportunities for contact develop, decided, okay, we may indulge these to a degree. Perhaps China would be a better example here. We may indulge these new contacts to a degree, but not at the expense of massive cultural influence. The Chinese, for example, would tolerate a little bit of European missionary activity as long as the Europeans were respectful of Chinese ways and dressed like Confucian scholars, but they were not interested in more significant cultural interpenetration, and indeed they would later move to block missionary activity to a greater extent as well. This is not a period of vibrant cultural exchange on a global basis. This is not a period of systematic cultural innovation. The main points in the early modern period are to recognize the obvious, that a number of different things are going on. The rise of Europe is a real fact. It doesn't have the same implications for some parts of the world as it does for others, but it's a real fact. But along with the rise of the West comes the establishment of really significant political units in other parts of the world that would long overshadow Western politics per se. Along with these political developments came the force of the biological exchange, which results from the inclusion of the Americas, a number of things going on that would prompt reactions from different societies. Many societies did have to make some decisions about how to handle new contacts with the West, and these decisions varied. But they also had to make decisions about the utilization of new foods, reactions to new diseases. They also had to make decisions about the impact of new imperial structures, land-based as well as sea-based. A lot was going on, and different regions would react differently. One final point. I mentioned, and it really needs to be repeated, that along with the specifics, the gunpowder empires, the Columbian Exchange, etc., we need to keep in mind the central theme. And that central theme was the intensification of economic relationships, which now also included the Americas, and at the end of the period, parts of the Pacific, in ways that would have deep impact. And as one final caution against placing too much emphasis on Western achievements in this whole pattern, one interpretation argues that what the West really managed in the early modern period was to place itself as a transmitter of American goods, and it was this transmission that actually served as the engine of the world economy with much more diverse benefits and implications than we usually think of when we think of the rise of the West alone.
Lecture 20, The World Economy, 1450 to 1750.
In introducing the early modern period of world history in our last session, I emphasized, I frankly think it's pretty obvious, that the big deal development underlying all the others was the intensification of world economic relationships and the inclusion of the Americas into those relationships. What we're talking about today fleshes this basic statement out, adds detail, adds theoretical rigor as we talk about the emergence of a new kind of world economy, again, obviously, Americas included. The intensification point is really vital. When we talked about the world network in the post-classical period, we mentioned, for example, that by the time of the Song Dynasty in China, the world network was really capable of having an impact on basic manufacturing patterns, increasing China's stake in this industrial sector, making silk, porcelain, etc. When we talk about the early modern period, we're talking about the same kind of intensification operating in a whole set of different economies and operating at a higher level. The device we'll use to explore these points is, again, called world economy theory. It's the child of an American sociologist, Emanuel Wallerstein, who has a number of books on the subject, fairly thick, fairly intriguing, and fairly controversial. I find world economy theory, which is not absolutely brand new. It utilizes some Marxist perceptions, and it utilizes economic work on dependency theory. I find world economy theory a really useful device to talk about relationships in the early modern period and relationships that would endure even beyond, even indeed, to the present day. The theory has, in my judgment, three advantages, in addition to illustrating the general points about intensification. First of all, it clarifies new systematic inequalities in international economic relationships that begin to emerge in the early modern period, and through this, help show why societies otherwise as different as Latin America and Poland actually can be viewed through something of the same lens. Second, it talks about relationships within societies between export and import activities, economic position in the world economy, and political structures and labor systems. And these relationships are really interestingly interconnected, and I think the interconnections are in many cases plausible. And the third advantage, which obviously we will evoke today but have to come back to, is world economy's utility in helping to explain why certain kinds of economic patterns internationally endure so long, how hard they are to get rid of. The theory has been, however, widely criticized, and we have to note this too. Indeed, I think exploring the criticisms helps make the theory more useful. It's a theory that leaves out some factors. And we will note in the following discussion that Wallerstein has almost no place for culture. I think culture is very important, even in the early modern world economy, and I would try to add cultural factors in. There's surprisingly little attention, actually, to explicit technologies, and I think these can be added in without too much difficulty. So there are certain omissions. Almost inevitably, there are oversimplifications, and we'll point out some of these as well. Wallerstein is generalizing about a wide array of territories and situations, and his model sometimes just shades off from necessary detail. This is not too hard to fix, but we need to work on fixing it. The theory has trouble dealing with change, and that's perhaps one of the most telling deficiencies. It's very easy using the theory to say society X is in this position at this time. But when society X changes from this position to that position, all the theory can do is say, gee, it shifted. We need to use the next category. Doesn't deal with change and or explain change too clearly. And finally, also extremely important for the early modern period, the theory does not do justice to the complexity of patterns in Asia, and indeed may really distort. This has been the most recent attack, and we need to build this criticism in. So, we're presenting a theory. I think it's useful for this period and the next, and even into our own day. It has flaws. It can be amended. And let's get going. Wallerstein introduces three key concepts. He actually has four, but I'm going to simplify the simplification just a little bit. First of all, he talks about core societies. These are societies that are the winners in the early modern world economy. And I'll explain their specific characteristics a bit more in a moment. Second, he talks about peripheral societies. These are the losers. And again, they have several characteristics that attach to their dependent, weaker position. And third, because not all societies were fully enmeshed in the world economy at this point, he also talks about external societies, where prosperity may or may not exist, but where it's not primarily dependent on global economic relationships. And we'll need this category as well, although we also need to adjust Wallerstein's use of it. All right, one other preliminary. Wallerstein argues that these economic relationships, particularly core-periphery, which is the crucial duo, these economic relationships are born with the early modern period. We can see that elements of these relationships existed even in the post-classical period. Not as rigorous because the intensity of the linkages wasn't as great, but there were societies that benefited more from exchange than others did. For example, China or the Middle East. And there were societies that tended to produce cruder products in their efforts to get into the game, for example, Western Europe. So the relationships are not brand new, but we can start with the early modern because they certainly become more rigorous at this point. Here's what a core society is. A society like Spain or Portugal in the initial phases of the early modern period, a society like Britain, France, or Holland by the 17th century. A core society makes profits from the world economy by doing three things simultaneously. First, it exports finished goods because you can make more money with finished goods because you have to pay for more stages of the production process than with less finished goods. So it's an exporter of largely manufactured products. Second, it organizes the trading companies in which world commerce is carried. So it makes money not just from manufacturing, but also from commercial transactions. And third, it builds the ships and runs the ships that carry the trade as well, another source of profit. Of course, there's risk in all these levels as well. Sea trade in the early modern period was frequently beset by accidents, piracy, etc., so profit wasn't assured. But in the long term, the core profits from the world economy because of its capacity to operate superior activities and facilities in these three categories. Economic advantage is, however, closely linked to political advantage. And here Wallerstein isn't always clear as to which comes first. Probably, actually, in his view, the politics comes first. In Wallerstein's view, core societies not only have profitable economic relationships internationally, they also have fairly strong states. The connection is quite clear. In the first place, if you're profiting from the international economy, your tax revenues go up, so you can afford a more elaborate system of government. Second, if you have a strong government backed by a strong military, you can intervene in international situations in ways that will help position your merchants advantageously. So, advantageous economic position coupled with political strength. And third, Wallerstein argues that core societies, and he's certainly empirically correct for the early modern period, core societies will increasingly adopt wage labor systems because they need the capacity to use wages to motivate workers, to move them around where manufacturing opportunities exist. Other systems of labor simply won't work as well. Again, as a matter of fact, there's no question that wage labor spread in the early modern period. Whether it's quite so inherently attached to Wallerstein's system, one could debate. Peripheral societies are the mirror image of core. They have dependent economies through which they will import expensive stuff from the core primarily. They will export cheap stuff, raw unprocessed goods of one sort or another. The trade will be carried by merchants from the core, so peripheral societies have a fairly small merchant class, mainly engaged in local exchanges, not non-existent, but small. And peripheral societies will depend heavily on the ships from the core economies as well. So they will, obviously, tend to lose money in international economic exchange. They're just as fully engaged in it as the core, but they're engaged at a series of systematic disadvantages. Peripheral societies will also have weak governments. Their governments will be weak because, again, they don't have the tax revenues to do much better, and they're also weak because the core will want to keep them weak so that its merchants and its interventions will not encounter significant political resistance. Peripheral economies, finally, will rely not primarily on wage labor, at least in the early modern period, but on forced or coercive labor, slavery or harsh serfdom. Wallerstein isn't necessarily entirely clear as to why this is so. The argument obviously would be that because you're producing cheap products, you need cheap labor. But I think we can add one ingredient here that helps explain the situation more fully. Remember that in the early modern period, many peripheral societies also faced a labor shortage because of the die-off of native populations. If it relied on wage labor, the wages would tend to be fairly high because of supply and demand. So the effort was instead to introduce slavery or some form of serfdom in order to cut those costs that would result from a market economy operating on its own. Coercive labor was an extensive form. These relationships, and again we're talking about economic, political, and social system or labor system relationships, these relationships are clearly easily uncovered in the early modern period. Again, the great core societies were initially Spain and Portugal, but then their position slipped as they failed to capitalize on their economic advantage and passed increasing manufacturing and trade opportunities northward in Europe. And ultimately, the great core societies were the societies of much of the European Northwest, France, Holland, Britain, and some other participants to a lesser degree. These were the societies that ultimately generated the great trading companies, British, Dutch, East India companies, etc., that clearly organized the trade and sent the ships. These were the societies also that experienced a significant and steady increase of manufacturing. Both craft manufacturing, pouring artistic goods into the world economy, but also domestic or home production, domestic manufacturing, where mostly rural workers would combine some agriculture with work making thread, cloth, simple metal equipment, nails, that sort of thing. The core societies then, as you actually look at them, clearly illustrate the increasing realization that money was to be made by organizing the trade very deliberately, and increasingly realizing that money was to be made by emphasizing new levels of manufacturing. We do need, again, as I mentioned earlier, to guard against oversimplification. France and Britain, both core societies, were clearly not the same society in the early modern period. France is a classic illustration of Wallerstein's claim that core societies will have strong governments with strong militaries. The British government wasn't feeble, but this was, of course, a period in which Britain underwent considerable political turmoil and emerged with a relatively small government and periodically a fairly weak military, though always a strong navy. In other words, Wallerstein's basic claims about the core probably work, but we need to be aware that we need to make some internal distinctions as well. The periphery, the classic periphery, of course, was Latin America. Latin America produced sugar, produced silver, produced wood products, produced other goods that were not processed there for the most part, but sent elsewhere. Latin America did, in its colonial period, experience quite weak governments. Weak not only because of core intervention, but also because the landlords and mine owners in the Latin American economy wanted to be free from government regulation as they worked to exploit their coercive labor. Certainly, Latin America developed coercive labor systems. The importation of slaves, particularly to the Caribbean and Brazil, for work in sugar plantations was a classic case in point. But in other areas also, with regard to native or mestizo populations, Latin American economies featured essentially versions of serfdom where labor would be partly coerced, partly forced either to work certain days for the mine or estate owner or to turn over certain percentages of produce, systems such as the encomienda and the hacienda system. They're not called serfdom in Latin American history, but If we step back a bit, they have very similar overtones. Peripheries could develop elsewhere. Wallerstein notes that by the 18th century, peripheries were developing in parts of Eastern Europe, particularly Poland, where amid another set of harsh serfdom conditions, emphasis increasingly went to producing grain for sale in Western markets. As Britain particularly converted increasingly to manufacturing, it would need to import food from other places. They sought this food at low prices. Poland and other parts of Eastern Europe were willing to oblige. And again, weak government. The Polish government was notoriously weak in the early 18th century. Harsh labor conditions, serfdom. and reliance on the export of relatively cheap products carried in Western ships in patterns organized by Western merchant companies, etc. Africa, West Africa particularly, can also be seen as a peripheral economy if we take the step of arguing that slaves constitute something of an unprocessed good. African slave systems obviously developed through a combination of African merchant and political organization seeking the slaves and bringing them to the coast, occasionally with some direct European intervention, and then selling them to European slave traders on the coast. The good was, again, relatively unprocessed. The ships and the commercial companies were European. And in return, African merchants and political figures received processed goods, again, from the core. The key goods were, again, slaves, sugar, silver, wood products. A bit later, cotton would be added to the mix. The core products that went into the world economy were particularly guns, of great interest, for example, to African political leaders, and also an increasing array of European craft products, tapestries, paintings, fancy furniture, that sort of thing, that could adorn the homes of the successful members of the peripheral economy. Peripheral economies, it should be added, were poor, but there could be some very rich people who made money from the agricultural estates and the mines. Mostly these people would not put their money back into the local economy, but money there was. All right. Here, too, with the periphery, we need to note some oversimplifications. If West Africa was a periphery, we have to note that its governments were much stronger than those of Latin America, much more capable of regulating European activity. The specifics of the pattern are distinct, and again, we need to guard against Wallersteinian oversimplification. Other societies began to demonstrate at least a few peripheral characteristics by the 18th century, particularly as European intervention increased in India and in what is now Indonesia. Economies were increasingly turned to production of goods like spices, teas, etc. The economy as a whole was not yet shifted to peripheral status, but some peripheral characteristics were developing. Again, Wallerstein can't explain changes of this sort. You have to look at military and political intervention, the use of military technology, but he can pick up the category once it begins to emerge. There are some rough spots, quite apart from the oversimplification. What does one do, for example, with the British colonies of North America? The South clearly was a periphery. As Southerners concentrated on the production of sugar and other goods for sale to Europe, they fall quite clearly into a peripheral category, and later on they would actually be a periphery of the American North, particularly as cotton production spread. But for the middle colonies particularly, and for New England, it's not quite so easy to figure out where to put them in the Wallersteinian scheme. These areas had a significant local merchant class. They did some manufacturing. They ran some shipping. They're not yet core, i.e. they're certainly dependent on European monitoring. But it's just not an easy category, and we just have to recognize not every size fits all in this theoretical discussion. The key issue, however, as I mentioned before, the key issue is Asia. Wallerstein doesn't necessarily talk in great detail about Asia in his treatment of the early modern period, but the implications of his work would suggest that Asia must be viewed largely through the lens of externality. That is, the Asian economy is not sufficiently involved in world trade to be affected by world trade dimensions one way or another. This position, which feeds and is fed by real misperceptions about Asia's economic role in the world at this point, by misperceptions about degrees of isolation, degrees of disdain for commerce, all the old stereotypes, particularly applied to China, but sometimes more widely as well, these perceptions have to be dispelled in order to understand the key point. And with this, the notion of externality has to be largely dispelled as well. There was one clear external Asian economy by the 17th century, and that was the economy of Japan. the Japanese decision substantially to isolate, taken around 1600, to cut off elaborate contacts with the West, included new regulations against Japanese trade with other societies, new regulations against foreigners working in Japan, and without question, Japan's economy was not